Now, while U.S. delegates at the Durban conference think a new climate treaty is premature, one American state is going ahead on its own. California is set to limit climate warming gases starting in 2013. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the state's argument is that it's good for the economy.
California's climate law, known as AB 32, is a big step at a time when the state's economy is shaky. It puts a statewide cap on the amount of greenhouse gases coming out of smokestacks and tailpipes. At a hearing recently in Sacramento, skeptics gave state regulators an earful. Among them was single mother Kathy West.
I'm a maintenance mechanic at the ConocoPhillips refinery. At our Santa Maria refinery, we just hired 12 operators and two mechanics. What's going to happen to their future, their families? What about your jobs when you get rid of the refining out of California?
There's no doubt this measure will make electricity and gas prices go up. How much is a matter of much debate. Some say thousands of dollars a year for businesses. The state says costs pale in light of new business the law will create. Mary Nichols runs the Air Resources Board, which administers the law. She says capping emissions forces companies to adapt.
Putting that cap on top of that whole system would be the best way to unleash the power of private capital to really get the most out of not just research and development, but actual deployment of green technologies.
My name is Matt Horton. I'm the CEO of Propel Fuels.
Propel Fuels is the kind of green technology that Nichols is talking about. The company installs seals, gaskets, hoses, underground tanks, and pumps that can handle biofuels. Companion laws to AB 32 will require more of them, and they're already being dispensed at gas stations like this one near San Francisco.
We did start out in Seattle as a company. We did move down here to California because it's a great market, a lot more vehicles, a lot more consumers that are interested in renewable fuels.
Horton says the climate laws create business.
We would not be here in the state if it weren't for the favorable policies that the state government had enacted.
Propel will open its 27th station this year. Most are in California. Customers like Sean Leong say, bring it on. Leong owns a 1984 Mercedes that can run on straight biodiesel, like the recycled vegetable oil pumped at this station.
It's my lifestyle I choose. I own a florist, and, you know, we don't create pollution. We try not to. My home has solar panels on it.
In fact, Leong is disappointed that the station here only pumps fuel with 5% biodiesel. He prefers the pure stuff. Some drivers are looking beyond the environmental benefits. Student Andre Savastru has modified his car to run on 85% ethanol, which is also sold at this station.
You get a great deal of difference in performance. Personally, I've got about 40 to 50 horsepower more.
The biggest reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, however, will have to come from refineries and power plants. Each company will get allowances to emit a certain amount. If they can't live within the cap, they can pay someone else to reduce gases somewhere else. And that means business for a company called Jayco Environmental. Just outside San Francisco, hundreds of cast-off refrigerators are scattered across the floor of a warehouse. Michael Dunham cuts into one with a power saw. He calls it filleting the fridge. The local electric utility pays people $35 each for these old, inefficient appliances. They're a drain on the electricity grid. They're brought here to refrigerator purgatory, where Jayco takes over. Dunham pries apart the fridge with a shovel.
The most interesting thing we ever found was a rattlesnake.
What Dunham's after is the 10 pounds of foam that's inside the walls of the fridge.
And embedded in that 10 pounds is 1 pound of CFC-11 gas.
CFC-11 is a chlorofluorocarbon, a form of freon and a very powerful greenhouse gas, the kind that warms the planet. There are other CFCs in the fridge's compressor as well.
It will all go up into the atmosphere if it's not taken care of. So what we do is we capture it.
Jayco removes the foam and other CFCs in the refrigerator's compressor and sends it out to be destroyed. California's climate law sets up a system to verify that the CFCs are destroyed. Each pound that's eliminated creates a credit. A company called EOS Climate buys those credits and then sells them to California companies that need to reduce their carbon footprint. Jeff Cohen, vice president of EOS, says CFCs are a climate time bomb buried inside old refrigerators.
So what we did was create a financial incentive to pull this stuff out. to address the remaining banks of CFCs, not only in the U.S., but around the world.
So what regulators in California are doing is turning greenhouse gases into a commodity. You can make money by getting rid of that commodity, whether it's CFCs or methane or carbon dioxide. The experiment officially begins January 1st, 2013. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Part of California's experiment could involve what's called carbon ranching. We'll hear about that tomorrow. Yesterday on this program, we followed up on California's own strategy on climate change. Rather than waiting for global action, California passed its own law. The state begins enforcing it in just over a year. It is supposed to limit emissions of greenhouse gases from factories, power plants, and eventually vehicles. Already, businesses are looking for ways to reduce their emissions. And NPR's Christopher Joyce reports that one option could be growing weeds.
Let's say you run a power plant in California. You can reduce your emissions footprint by buying new, cleaner equipment. But that can be expensive. So instead, you can help pay to protect a growing forest, for example, because it sucks carbon dioxide out of the air. Or you can pay a farmer to capture methane from a pond of pig waste. The market for these so-called greenhouse gas offsets is growing already, and lots of people are angling to come up with new kinds of them. One potential bumper crop lies in the state's huge agricultural heartland, the San Joaquin Valley.
And what we found was that this area was a really big source of greenhouse gases.
When biologist Wendy Silver walks through the valley, she sees something that most people don't notice. Greenhouse gases coming up out of the peat-rich soil, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane. At the University of California at Berkeley, Silver studies ways to reduce those gases. That could create offsets that farmers and ranchers could sell to businesses trying to reduce their carbon footprint. One way to cork up those gases is to flood the peatland and grow a tall grass called tule. Silver and Berkeley environmental scientist Dennis Baldacci take me to see a field of densely packed reeds about 12 feet high swaying in the wind. Over centuries, this stuff breaks down into peat soil.
These things have grown in this region for about 10,000 years or so, and if you can stick your hand down, if you want to feel the stuff, you can actually see.
I'll let you do that.
Okay. Undecomposed tule. There we go. This is the stuff that will form the soils that are now being lost as this land's been drained.
Oops. Smell it. You smell the sulfur? That tells you that the air is gone. So take a good sniff. Smells like rotten eggs.
The flooded soil means there's very little oxygen down there. That keeps bacteria from chewing carbon out of the plants and soil and sending it up into the atmosphere. And as the reeds grow, and they grow fast, they suck carbon out of the atmosphere like a big sponge.
It's pretty clear when you see this beautiful green swath of wetland growing next to the brown hills at this time of year. You can see this is carbon.
Flooding would return the land to the way it used to be, but that would reduce acreage for farmers and ranchers. If they can get paid enough for the greenhouse gases they capture, though, it could be profitable for them. And local rice farmers are interested as well. They flood land to grow rice, and that could capture greenhouse gases, too.
Here, we may have a small area, but it's a very, very intense carbon sink. And that's the strength of this project.
But there are kinks to work out. For example, flooding land may reduce carbon and nitrous oxide emissions, but increase methane.
So that's part of the reason we're looking at this, is how much methane comes out, how much carbon gets stored in, and is it sustainable? Can we keep that positive balance of carbon coming in?
Silver calls this carbon ranching, an alternative to expensive retrofits at factories. Derek Brokoff is with Climate Action Reserve, which ensures that these offsets actually do what they're supposed to do, lower emissions.
A lot of these emission reductions, you can do that a lot more cheaply, and so it reduces the overall cost.
California officials are interested in carbon ranching, not least because the state government needs to reduce emissions from its own facilities and vehicles, and it owns plenty of land in the Delta. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Let's go next to Florida, where Governor Rick Scott says his administration is focused on restoring the Everglades. To environmentalists and others concerned about the future of the so-called River of Grass, that is welcome news, although many are skeptical about what he says. In his first year in office, Rick Scott has overseen big budget cuts in the programs and agencies vital to Everglades restoration. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen has more.
At the annual dinner of the Everglades Foundation recently, there was a surprise guest.
First off, thank you. Thank you very much. And
Governor Rick Scott made a brief appearance before the group with some reassuring words.
We are absolutely focused on making sure the right thing happens for the Everglades.
It's a new focus for Republican Rick Scott, a businessman who's a relative newcomer both to Florida and to politics. After taking office earlier this year, his statements and actions suggested he saw environmental protection not so much as a goal, but as a problem. With the legislature, he dismantled a powerful state agency, the Department of Community Affairs. That office helped control development and protected natural areas, including the Everglades. He also eliminated funding for Florida Forever, a program that allowed the state to buy and preserve land in critical areas. Jonathan Ullman of the Sierra Club says Scott's record on Everglades restoration is clear.
Up until now, it would have to be negative.
The move that has had the most direct impact involves the South Florida Water Management District, the state agency charged with restoring the Everglades. Scott approved a plan that forced the district to slash its budget and draw down its reserves.
As a result, there were massive layoffs, and especially hard hit were Everglades Science.
More than 250 employees, including many top scientists, were let go. Also gone is much of the money set aside for land acquisition, land that includes more than 100,000 acres now owned by U.S. Sugar available to the state under a deal brokered by former Governor Charlie Crist.
All right, everybody hang on.
On his cattle ranch north of Lake Okeechobee, Woody Larson has a load of visitors on board a swamp buggy. It's a high-rise, all-terrain vehicle useful in running cattle across marshy areas on his ranch. Larson has just signed an agreement with the state of Florida that will pay him tens of thousands of dollars each year to turn some of his ranch into wetlands. Instead of using canals to drain nutrient-rich water that eventually ends up in the Everglades, he's keeping it here. The head of the South Florida Water Management District, Melissa Meeker, says projects like this are a cost-effective way to improve water quality in the Everglades.
When you hear the governor and the administration talk about public-private partnerships, this is exactly the type of thing that we're talking about. We're looking for innovative ways that we can work to reduce the upfront capital investment of the state and taxpayer dollars.
Meeker says programs like this aren't a substitute for land acquisition. To restore the Everglades, she says Florida will have to buy and preserve more land. And when she talked about it with Governor Scott recently, she says he agreed.
And we started to talk about ideas and he said, stop. If we agree on a plan, we'll get it funded. So, I mean, he's committed to getting it funded, and I don't feel that's going to be a huge hurdle for us.
Former Florida Governor and Senator Bob Graham says the Everglades can only be fixed by the state and federal government working in partnership. And Graham worries that marriage right now is on the rocks.
One of the leadership responsibilities of the governor will be to restore that level of confidence that the federal government has a reliable partner that is capable of delivering on its half of the partnership for Everglades salvation.
Graham and other Everglades advocates say they're encouraged by what Governor Scott and others in his administration are saying, but now they're impatient for action. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.